I got.
I'm sorry, folks. Oh. My dog said it.
You've excited the dog, Nick. You've gotten there like, what? Two stops there, Peril?
Two stops?
I didn't
know that was yours. So.
All right, and welcome back to Street PX, a live broadcast, because we're actually doing a Google Hangout right now, or at least maybe for those that are watching right now, if you're listening to the podcast, we missed you, so keep an eye out for our future ones. Anyway, this is Street PX, a photography podcast focused on reported, you know, street, documentary, photojournalism. My name is Casper, and as a very special treat today, we have a special co-host.
Hey, how you doing, folks? My name is Pete Rosos. I am a photographer around the area here, and I make pictures with film and digital.
Yes, and if you take a look at some of our past episodes, you'll notice that Pete was a previous guest on our show. So if you want to learn a little bit more about him, we'll be dropping that link in the show notes so you can go back and listen to his episode directly following this one. But definitely, thank you so much for coming and helping out.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
And big love to Jim, who's out on the East Coast right now, and that's why he couldn't join us this go. But it worked out well, because Jim's not necessarily a film shooter, but Pete is.
I hope I can fulfill that for you.
Excellent. Well, first thing I want to do is just throw out some love to our sponsor, Glass Key Photo. That's San Francisco's premier analog photography store. And if you have been under a rock for a while, they have changed location from their Haight Street facility over to Sutter and Van Ness, right there at that corner. And it's a beautiful location, isn't it?
Yes.
Also, the meeting point for our film walk that's happening here tomorrow, or as you're listening to this once it posts on Saturday, we're getting together at 2 o'clock there at Glass Key Photo if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area for the Film Week photo walk. And if you're not in San Francisco, get some people together. If you're in Houston, if you're in Miami, if you're in Chicago, whatever location that is, get some people together, lay the digital up on the shelf and shoot film.
Agreed.
Yeah. There's just something about film, and that's why we do this kind of film week thing each year, which we want to do more.
Challenge yourself, folks. Take 1 week out of every month and only shoot film.
Exactly.
Give that a shot and see what that does for you.
You're going to be surprised in how you're going to feel about it after you try it out. But on that note, we do have two contests going on this week as well, or at least for the next month. First contest is for all of you natural film shooters. Go over to the Street PX Lounge and share your film scans over in the lounge and hashtag it with film contest. And at the end, once it wraps up for our 50th episode, we'll announce our winners there in October 20th. And the best photos get some free prints. And from what I hear, I think Nick's got some prints. Nick Mayo, who's on the show today, has got some prints he wants to share. Second contest is going to be a social media sharing. So go and follow us on Facebook or on Twitter and share our show, our most recent episode here, to your friends and followers. And we're going to take a list of everybody that has followed us, has liked our Facebook page or shared our posts. And there's going to be a big drawing for some free film, some t-shirts, all kinds of stuff. We just want to give away a bunch of shit. That's our goal. That's our goal. So anyway, that's our contest. Here's our plugs. First plug is Jay Blakesburg, if you've been following the board, we just had an interview with him. Jay is a rock and roll photographer that's been shooting for about 40 years now and has an intimidating client list from Tom Waits to Neil Young to Jerry Garcia. He followed the Grateful Dead for years and years. This guy is a legend in the music scene out here in the Bay Area. He's got a career retrospective show coming up to the Harvey Milk Photo Center in November. That opens up on November 9th, going until January. Opening receptions on the 9th. He also has a lecture and a show and tell going on in November 11. But you do have to sign up for that one. That's limited seats. But that's at the Harvey Milk Photo Center in San Francisco.
Yeah, and what we got going on over here in the East Bay, if you're around this area, there's a new collective out there called the East Bay Photography Collective. They are obviously, by their namesake, based here in the East Bay. It's a fledgling collective. But they already got a set of workshops up there. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because since we're talking Film Week, these guys actually have a lot of film-related stuff. They have a workshop, for example, that teaches you how to develop your film in beer, wine, whiskey, or coffee. They have another workshop that's specific to large format photography, large format film photography. It's not your average workshop, but go check them out. They have a fantastic sort of scant website, but enough of the information you need at ebpco.org. They also have a Facebook group that you can join up at. It's facebook.com/groups/EBPCO. It's started off by a guy named Vince Donovan. He, for the longest time, was one of the co-owners of Photo Booth SF and The Mission, if any of you guys remember that back in the day. And they have a lot of interesting things coming up, specifically film-based stuff. So go check them out.
Cool. And the last thing, and the most appropriate thing here we want to plug is Nick Mayo. Our guest today has a wonderful exhibit going on. It's a part of the Art Prize that's there in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And if it comes to town there, it's going to be at the Ferris Coffee Trust Building September 20th through October 8th. So if you want to see some of his work in print right in front of you, eye to eye or eye to print, go check that out. So enough about the plugs. We want to get right into this episode and start talking to Nick. So we want to welcome him and thank him for taking the time to sit with us and struggle through this live show with us. So how you doing here today, brother?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
We're slowly kind of getting into the live flow here.
Sure. I completely understand.
I'm trying to get accustomed to this whole broadcasting thing.
I wouldn't do any better, so I commend you for having to deal with words in live.
Yes, yeah, it's always better when it's polished, but that's okay. That's what editing is for our Friday episode.
There you go.
Well, I got in touch with you through a mutual friend of ours, Steve Abbott. He was actually the one that led me to your front door, and I got to taking a look at some of your awesome channel over there, Nick Exposed. It's on YouTube, yes. But fellow lover of film, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and we'll kind of get that kicked off.
Yeah, so I'm a film photographer based out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. I host a YouTube channel called Nick Exposed. Nick Exposed is kind of my branding across the board. So Instagram, Nick Exposed, YouTube, Nick Exposed. And I also have a Facebook page, but that kind of gets populated with all the Instagram stuff. I am a lover of film and just absolutely love pouring into the film community and just helping whatever way I can. And the YouTube channel has been a big way for me to just give back to this amazing community, especially within film that we have.
What first got you into photography?
Yeah, so I come from, I've been an artist ever since I was a kid. I used to draw and, just doodle and everything. But I kind of took this path to where I was doing sales jobs, marketing jobs for a while, and decided that I wanted to go back into just artistic, creative expression, and thought that that was going to be through web design. I was really enjoying building websites back when it was just CSS and HTML, so started making some business claims there and started into business for web design, then transitioned over to graphic design. And then naturally transitioned over to photography after taking photos for different clients, graphic design and websites, and just kind of really found my passion in my artistic expression through photography and then into film photography.
Well, what was the impetus that got you into film? What was the key moment where you're just like, I think I'm going to pick up film? Because it sounds like you started to get interested into this type of thing when digital photography was still young enough where you could go out and you could do it. What made you gravitate towards film?
Yeah, you know, I thought back multiple times about this question, and I do know that there was a certain point to where these filters and different things were coming out to where people were trying to emulate film, and I'd never known what film looked like up until that point, except for the prints that we'd get back from CVS when I was a kid and That's not exactly the greatest representation of what film has to offer, but just going through and realizing that I was looking for something greater than just what digital had to offer. And instead of having to go through and apply all sorts of different effects and different presets and all sorts of stuff, I just kind of figured why not go and kind of explore the original medium and really kind of trace the roots back to where it all started. And I mean, over the last 4.5 to 5 years, I've gradually switched over to film more and more. And then in the last 3.5 years, it's been essentially 99% of the stuff that I'm shooting is all on film. Majority of my personal work is on film, and I just absolutely love it. It kind of captures, to just expand a little bit further, it kind of captures just the soul of the images that I'm trying to present out to the world. I'm a grain junkie, and the more grain, the better. T-Max 3200 is by far my all-time favorite black and white film. In my film fridge next to me, I have about 36 rolls of it still stuffed into my freezer, and I kind of trickle through them every now and then.
You would be absolutely jealous, because actually the sponsor of the show, Glass Key Photo, about a week and a half ago, they posted a thing up on Facebook. They got several bricks of the T-Max 3200, which expired only in 2014. And,
oh, wow.
It had been in the freezer the whole time. So it was literally just like, and we have something in common, because that is when, I don't know if you remember, it was like about a year ago, Kodak announced that they were going to bring back one of their Chrome films. Mm-hmm. And people were all agog about that. I was not happy about that, because, look, Chrome film is beautiful, no question. Colors, all that type of stuff. But if we're talking about usefulness, please, why did you not bring back the 3200 T-Max?
That's right, yeah.
Best high-speed ISO film ever.
It is amazing. It's incredible, and it has so much soul and life into it. And I use it like almost solely for documenting family work. So my wife or my nieces or anytime I get to be around just family, I pull the T-Max out and just get to just, I don't know, there's just something to it to where it just embodies so much just soul and characteristic that I haven't found in anything else, even pushing film. So, yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Oh, well, it's funny, because about 4 months ago, I went back into my film archives from like 20 years ago. And back then, I used to shoot the T-Max 3200 a lot. And I went to go scan some of the stuff in. And after 20 years of time, that film held up fantastically. It scans beautifully. And then when you go in the dark room, it prints just stunningly gorgeous. And I'm, you know. I think we can both, you and me can both agree that Kodak should bring that film back next.
Oh, for sure. Yes. It's so much easier to focus when everything in the shot is just grain, you know, like trying to find focus in the darkroom. It's like, oh, I got it. I know that I got it, because everything is structured to it.
So what it's kicked beautiful. You into street photography?
That's probably an answer that I don't necessarily know how to approach. I think I just stumbled upon it. When I got into photography, it was when I really took like a big step forward in it. I was doing a 365 like photo a day challenge, and really kind of stepped into that. And I just kind of naturally gravitated towards the city, and naturally gravitated towards stuff that was constantly happening. Landscape and different work like that. I enjoy shooting it when I'm in the right area. But in West Michigan here, at least within the 30 minutes to an hour radius of where I'm at, if I'm going to do landscape, it's going to be either a farm town or, you know, just some rolling hills that I'm not necessarily blown away by. So
kind of becomes redundant.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's only so many pictures of barns that you can produce before they all start to look the same. Like, oh, there's another haystack, and, you know, like
a cow.
Yeah, exactly. So and at the same time, I had moved away, and when I got back in, or when I got into photography, I was moving back to Michigan from Virginia, and coming back into a city that before I kind of thought was just plain and mundane. Reapproaching it with a camera in my hand really allowed me to fall in love with the city that I'm in. And that, I think, probably played hand in hand with falling in love with street photography too, because it gave me a voice to be able to approach the city in a way that I'd never done so in the past. So, and then interacting with people. I absolutely love people. I love interacting with people. So getting to go out there and shove my camera in their face and kind of force some of them to interact with me is pretty fun sometimes too.
Hey, you, look at me.
Yeah.
Hi there.
I go, yeah, I host, like meetups and photo walks. And a lot of the times I'll host them out in Chicago. And a lot of the guys that go with me out to Chicago have never shot in Chicago before, and they've never shot in a big city. And I'm no stranger of getting in people's, I'm not Bruce Gilden by any means. Like, I'm not like, you know, assaulting someone with my camera, but at the same time, I'm definitely close and I'm definitely within distance to where after I take the photo, there's still a decent amount of time for them to be able to interact with me. They haven't walked by me by the time I've gotten my photo. So people, people that go with me on these photo walks tend to find my style a little abrasive, but I kind of love it when people approach me and they're frustrated, because at the end of it, 9 times out of 10, I'll leave with a new friend and they'll be happy with it in the end. So
you say Chicago. Let me ask you, what part of Chicago are you going to? Are you taking them?
Like into the city. We typically start off around Central Cameron and just kind of work our way out.
So the folks that you bring out on the photo walks, are these folks that are from the area around there, or they just come from Grand Rapids as well, or do they come from different places?
There's some of them that come from Grand Rapids, but it's mostly the Midwest. I've done a couple different meetups, and they've grown each time, and they're either from Chicago area, or I've had some guys from Milwaukee come down. I had some guys from Detroit come over, and so they're just kind of all over the Midwest, but Chicago is a nice little place to kind of break people into street photography if they've never really stepped into it.
That's true.
And, yeah, I think what is it, Chicago is a very different vibe, I think, than, well, I mean, every place has its own vibe.
Chicago has that big city but Midwest feel.
Sure.
Like, sure. There's a dynamic there that's hard to recreate.
Yeah, it's quite a bit different. My wife and I recently went out to New York, and it was my first time visiting the big city out there. And being to Chicago so often, I kind of thought I knew what to expect going out to New York, but it's completely different. I was in complete culture shock. We were out there for 4 days, and we solely went out there. It was my 30th birthday, and we went out there so that way I could use all 4 days to just shoot. And for the first like day and a half to 2 days, it was really just me kind of being overwhelmed by the city, not having any idea where to point my camera. I kind of just wanted to like curl up in a ball and just cry in a corner somewhere and be like, just bring me back to Chicago. I don't know.
I'm assuming you landed in Manhattan.
Yeah, we started off in Manhattan. So
yeah, it was. Yeah. I talked about on the show before, I spent 6 days and put down about 70, 80 miles. Because you just walk and you never hit the end.
Oh, for sure. It's crazy. It's absolutely insane. And I left with this like dissatisfaction of going, I kind of expected going and coming back with, I mean, I came back with a lot. I shot 32 rolls of HP5 out there. But I kind of expected coming back having experienced at least enough to walk away and go, yeah, I experienced New York, but I left going like, there's no way, like I haven't even touched the surface.
You kind of licked it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know. But it's left me with this desire to go back so many more times. And I want to just fall in love with that city. And I just want to document that city so much. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you were talking about your wife a while ago. Now, you guys do weddings together, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yep. Is that what you do to kind of keep the lights on? You're a professional wedding photographer?
Yeah. So, I work a full-time job during the day, and then my wife is a full-time college student, so to supplement her income, we've taken on weddings for the last 3 years full-time. And I say full-time, it's kind of full part-time. I mean, we do about 12 to 13 weddings a year. But even that, with Emily being she's a full-time art student, so she's constantly creating, and I'm constantly creating. So running the YouTube channel, doing my personal projects, working a full-time job, and doing weddings has definitely become, you know, it's a part-time wedding gig, but it's also full-time in a lot of ways. It just keeps us busy. So
It's a calendar full of text.
Yeah, it's I hate looking at the calendar because it's like so daunting. And I didn't like it wasn't until about a year and a half ago that I actually used a calendar anyway. I just kind of like did mental notes for meetings, be like, "Oh yeah, we'll do lunch next Wednesday." And I tend to remember that kind of stuff, but
write it on your arm. Yeah,
I started using the calendar and then now my calendar's mixed with Emily's calendar and I'm just looking at it and it, I just want to like, I get up in bed and I look at the calendar and I just want to roll back in bed and go, nope, I'm done. I'm
like, well, okay. I have a little bit of bad news for you. As someone who's talking from their early 40s, sure. The older you get, the more important that goddamn calendar gets. I'll tell you that right off the bat.
I bet.
That's truth. That's truth. Are you shooting film in these weddings?
Yeah, we do hybrid. So any of the bridal portraits, anything like that, I do on medium format film. I did a wedding 3 weeks ago for another film photographer, and he really just let me go to town. Not too many couples will allow you to deliver a bunch of grainy black and white photos of, you know, the ceremony and reception and everything like that, but he was all for it, so I shot quite a bit of film at his wedding.
One of the things that I noticed, I saw in one of your videos, you had mentioned, I believe, something about shooting most of the weddings in color. Mm-hmm. Your personal stuff is in black and white, and the wedding stuff that you do is in color.
Sure.
Is the color a factor? Could you elaborate on why you have that difference between shooting color for the weddings and shooting black and white personally?
Yeah, you know, I think just naturally my mind goes to gravitating in a direction of, like, splitting things off. I need to know what is work and what is play. And I feel like anytime I'm working with color, for the most part, I am working on a personal project. It's kind of a long-term here and there project with color. But for the most part, my color or my professional work is going to be done in color and my personal work is going to be done in black and white, which is fun because when I do incorporate black and white into weddings, like I said a couple weekends ago, getting to shoot a lot of black and white HP5 push to 1600, which is my jam. It kind of brought me into a place of being able to play at a wedding, and that doesn't happen too often, and I can't do it at every wedding. But yeah, so I think that that's probably the main reason. Otherwise, it's just, I mean, portraiture, I enjoy doing portraiture in color. So hopefully that answers right your on. Question.
Well, I want to just kind of shift us over to Nick Exposed, talk mm-hmm. a little bit about your show here. Just kind of started out, when did you first decide, hey, let me jump on front of the camera and start talking about film?
So I actually originally started recording videos last summer, did some vloggy stuff, kind of like just being inspired by Casey Neistat and that whole thing, tried just doing like the day in the life of type stuff. And I recorded probably 4 or 5 episodes of that, never put them up, never got fully through editing them, and realized that that was a format that I wasn't going to be able to, like, it just wasn't going to be sustainable, and it wasn't necessarily me. And then I kind of put it on the back burner because a lot of the equipment that I was trying to use for that, I had like a, it's probably in my desk somewhere around here, but it's this little Canon power shot from a while back, and it was just a 780p, and it didn't handle dark situations very well, and I don't know, I just became like kind of crippled with this fear of not having the right equipment and everything like that. And then this year I just made the plunge into going, you know, I'm gonna dedicate myself from doing this and only using my iPhone to record all the videos, and not be consumed by the quality of the videos, but be consumed by the quality of the content, and really just made the step and made it happen. So the idea was birthed long before last year, but it didn't actually come into to happening in a big way until March of this year, I think it was.
Excellent. And you're mostly talking about the use of film, inspirations, things like that. Does that sound like the kind of the core of what you're aiming for?
Sure. Yeah. It's, you know, I say it's a film channel, and there is a lot of talk about film. The community that I attract is very, very much film photographers. But I get messages every week from people that are just starting into photography and digital, and they're like, man, the stuff that you're covering is speaking to my heart so much, because I don't do gear reviews. I don't think anything wrong of gear. I love talking about gear, but at the same time, I think there's already plenty of voices out there talking about gear, and there's only a small handful of voices that are going into why is it that we're creating the work that we're creating? How is it that we're going to get to the places that we want to be? And what does that actually look like? And how I explained it to you the other day, I like going into the meat and potatoes versus talking about the forks and the knives.
Yeah, that's our thoughts too. I mean, gear will come up, obviously, but you know, we'll talk a little bit about it and then shift back. This show might be a little different because it's film-based, because we're going to get into scanners and stuff here soon.
Yeah, but no, what I can tell you personally, one of the things that I liked in watching several of your videos is it tends to be so much more substantive.
Hmm.
You know, the whole notion of like, okay, we can talk about gear, we can talk about film, we can talk about this, but what is the end game? What are you trying to ultimately express with the work that you do? And you tend to focus so much on that. It's please keep making stuff like that, please.
Thanks. Yeah, I sure will. I feel like the industry advances when we talk about, you know, gear, but the craft and artwork advances when we actually talk about, you know, the reasoning why. And I think there's place for both. I'm so excited by, you know, all of the different companies that, I mean, Yashica is toying around with coming out with new stuff, and then Polaroid just relaunched, and all these different things that are, there's huge moves that are happening in film photography right now. It looks like Kodak's really putting a large foot forward back into the film community and every, I mean, not that they ever really stepped out. They've been doing Vision 3 for so long and offering that to the prosumer. But, I'm so excited about that. And that does come from talks about gear. So I think there is a place for that. But at the same time, if all we focus on is gear, then the art form and the craft is going to die.
Yeah. Yeah. It always comes back to that, you know, this is a great pot roast. What stove did you use? Yeah.
But well, okay. And one of the things that I find out there is that a lot of folks who do any kind of photography blog, whether it's, film centric or digital centric, it's, you know, very rarely do you have people want to talk about the substance of the work itself.
Sure.
You know, to talk about the meat and potatoes and not the forks and knives.
Yep.
Right. You know, people like to talk about these are the forks and knives and here's how I use the forks and knives.
Sure.
And isn't the luster on these forks and knives really amazing? And with these forks and knives, I can cut through this kind of meat. And that's about as much as they'll touch on the meat. But in terms of the meat, and that was something that I found really fascinating when you started to go into zines and how to make a zine and mm-hmm. how to think about zines. I noticed that you tend to take, I'm assuming that the graphic design background probably plays a little bit of a role into how you put this stuff together.
Sure, absolutely.
But the main focus usually seems to be, okay, I have an idea and I really want to express it, and that should be the focus. You know, okay, sure, I shoot HP5, sure, I shoot with this, but that takes a backseat towards, you know, okay, here's the artistic expression I'm trying to let everybody know about.
Oh, absolutely.
That's fascinating. So does the graphic design element play a role into how you started to get into making zines?
Sure. I honestly would say that graphic design plays into so much of my photography, not just zines, but also the way that I lay out my compositions. I oftentimes gravitate towards simple compositions, but with very striking graphical elements, right? I like to use light and shadow in a very, I see it as light and shadow, and I fully recognize it as light and shadow, but I see it as shapes and objects to play with. But then going into the zine portion, understanding the flow of how something should move, understanding the layout and what an actual solid layout will do for the reading experience and for the viewer experience. I mean, when you think about books are presented in a way that I heard Ralph Gibson talk about it in another episode of something, but what did he say? He said, when you go to an exhibition, you're showing people how you shoot. And when you hand them a book, you're showing them how you see. Or, you know, something like that, to where it's when you're handing over a book, you're handing it over in a sequence and in a way that you're going, this is how I want you to approach the work. And there's really no other way that you're going to be able to approach it than the way that I lay it out, and that I'm forcing you in down this river trail of my work, if that makes sense. And I just think that, you know, coming from a graphic design background, I break things, and also from a marketing background, I break things down in a very different way, I find. And I hear from a lot of people that the way that I'm breaking down, not that it's any kind of like savant thing or, you know, I'm not trying to elevate myself. I'm just saying, like, this background has definitely played into, breaking things down in a way that I know it's going to flow well. I know it's going to direct the viewer's eye. I know that they're going to land on this page and then go back to this page. So how am I going to design the two to play off of each other? And how is those two going to build to the overarching story, if that makes sense?
Well, actually, you were talking about the jazz, mm-hmm. using music to in one of your videos on setting up a sequence.
Sure.
That was extremely fascinating to me, just the way that you described it, listening to the music and using that the imagery, mm-hmm. to kind of create a musical element. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a point to where we start to become just paralyzed when we have so many different options, when we have so many different ways that we can go. I mean, you can approach a zine in a million different ways. But when we hone in on something and we kind of give ourselves that constraint and that self-imposed limitation, I oftentimes approach my work through the thought process of music. I'm not a musician by any means. I don't really have the language to put towards music. But at the same time, I know how music makes me feel, and I know how I respond to music. And when I take that structure and I lay that over top of my composition of a zine, of a book, of an exhibition, all of a sudden I could start seeing in patterns that I wouldn't have gravitated towards in the first place, but I've constrained myself to those set of patterns, and all of a sudden the story starts to flow on its own, if that makes sense.
Oh, that makes, yeah. To me, that makes wonderful sense, in the sense of, I think, let me ask you this. Is there a particular rhythm that you feel? And I know that's, I'm getting maybe a little esoteric here, but in terms of when you have an idea of something that you want to work on a project, you know, obviously there's an inspiration. And for example, I think with your zine, it had to do specifically with this sort of jazz music feel, mm-hmm. That you did. When you go out to shoot that, from the time that you go to edit the stuff to the time that you start to make prints and arrange these things, is there a particular type of rhythm that you feel in every single process where that idea keeps repeating itself in the back of your head and eventually comes out that way? Or is it just something that happens more spontaneous, sure. as you go through everything?
You know,
I'm pretty deep here. I'm sorry. No, it's fascinating to me, though.
Pete, this is where my mind goes to these places as well. I love these types of questions. This is exactly what I love talking about. And I think for me, at least, it's definitely a natural progression. I feel like my mind just kind of, it finds these grooves, and it finds, you know, just the, I just fall into a pattern to where, like, all I can listen to is a single music, right? Like, uh-huh. lately in the dark room, in developing and everything, I've just been listening to classical over and over and over and over again. And, not that I made the work that I'm approaching right now through that mindset, but in approaching the work, I can't help but to fall into that mindset. Right. And I think it kind of, the reality is, on the Chicago zine, the first one that I did that's built off of jazz, if I would have said, hey, you know, I want to build it off of a Black Keys album, I could have done that just as well. But at the same time, I was responding to the place that I was in at the moment and the things that I was finding inspiring at the moment, and the story came from that. I mean, that same story could be told a million different ways, but I don't know. I just fall into a natural groove of, hey, right now I'm all I'm listening to is Chet Baker and Bill Evans, you know, in like just like grab it, or all I'm listening to right now is Vivaldi and, you know, Chopin, and it's weird, but it's just how my mind operates, and I just get into these things and I just like embracing them and seeing kind of what is influencing me and how I can partner with it at the moment to create a body of work.
Oh, that's awesome.
Reminds me, it's kind of like a time capsule. When I look back at, I have the zine right here, right? So if I go back through My Kind of Town, it just brings me back to that place that I was in, right? I can experience the jazz songs that I was listening to. I can hear Miles through this, you know, I can hear Coltrane through this, and it just puts me back in that place that I was, and I kind of like that, and I kind of love being able to offer just my experience in these pathways that I've found out to other people to experience as well.
Well, I think you also did that in that same video when you were talking about My Kind of Town. I think you had made mention about if you get the chance to put on this particular type of music while you're looking through you know, is that part of the idea of what you're getting at here with this?
You know, I hope that, and it's encouraging to hear when somebody reaches out and goes, dude, when I seen the zine, like I could almost see a musical pattern. And then when I heard, like, it made sense to me, and I put an album on and I got to approach it. And I had so many people after that video who had purchased the zine beforehand, and there was very, very, very little text in the zine. And actually the only thing that referenced jazz was, the beginning quote of Bill Evans. But when people heard that and they reapproached the zine with, you know, Miles on in the background or with Bill Evans on in the background, and then they came back to me and said, dude, it just bloomed out like a flower and I got to experience it in a whole new way. Like, that excites me, you know? Like, it's incredible.
Nice.
You think about when a song comes up or smell, things like this. So being able to bring these two elements together, I think just builds something greater in the end.
Sure. There's a bit of nostalgia, you know,
that just
naturally happens. And, I love having just these little pockets of time. And that's why I do like focusing on zines, because zines could be made in a much shorter time than actual book projects or anything like that.
What do you find is the advantage of a zine over a book?
It's more approachable, you know, like I have four books that were just released by photographers that I absolutely admire. And, right now I'm not able to pull the trigger on too many of them, and they're limited editions, so by the time I am able to, they're probably going to be sold out, you know. So I like that they're more approachable. I love having different price points for people to approach my work. I do think that there's definitely a place of galleries and showing work and being able to sell it at a you know, what we would see as a fine art price point. But then I think there's also a place of, I want as many people as possible to be able to own these projects, and to be able to approach these projects. And my end goal in general is that people were to approach my work in print form. So why would I make it an unapproachable price? And that's not a commentary on anybody's book or any, like, those are justified price points. It's just I can't always afford that, and I know that not everyone else can either. So I think a $15 zine, a $20 zine, a $10 zine is much more approachable and oftentimes accomplishes a very similar end result.
Right. They are a way of being able to access photography without having to deal with a 60, 70, or you were just talking about limited edition. If you go to a great bookstore and get a signed Kadelka.
Right.
$250, $500.
Seriously. You know, like,
yeah. Well, okay. Are you planning on doing any more videos talking, going more in depth about zine making or going into that kind of thing?
Yeah. So I think as of right now, I have maybe four or five in the series right now, but I have a few more. I'm going to be doing a layout video of how I actually lay them out to send in for print. And then actually this week I was brainstorming on another video, much going into what we were just talking about this idea of how is my graphic design background really shaped and directed that. I want to offer to people who don't have that language to put towards things, who don't have that experience to put towards things, and break it down in a very simple, almost here's a toolbox for you to pull from. Here's how you can direct viewers' eyes. Here's how you can work with common shapes and common tonality or anything like that. So I'll probably even break down some of my favorite books in my collection and how other photographers have done it extremely well, in my opinion. So that's one that I want to record. This winter will be a big point for me to be able to record much more of that as winter, as Michigan hits with our blanket of snow.
Yes, as you get that lovely lake effect snow that makes you like, I don't want to walk 2 feet outside of the house, right?
It's crazy. Like some days it's absolutely beautiful outside, but then you go out to shoot and it's your hands just feel like they're going to fall off even though you have gloves on and you can't even hit the shutter anymore because, your finger's frozen. It's just brutal.
It's a kind of wind that your skin's not the only thing that covered. It cuts right into your bones.
Totally.
It's what polar fleece was invented for.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so here's something for you. So if you're coming up on those winter months and you know it's going to be freezing cold and you know that you're going to be kind of limited in terms of getting out there and doing a lot of shooting like you normally would in the better months, do you have a dark room you can go into and print some of the stuff?
And that's been the thing. Yeah, it's so I just started printing with in the dark room maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago, and finally convinced Emily with the help of a friend who had a similar setup to what I built that it could be done in our little apartment and not take up an entire giant space, you know. And
yes.
So going back to talking about the New York trip that I recently took, actually you guys can see it behind me. There's probably about 15 rolls of film that are developed over hanging on the wall back there. And then I have maybe another 25 that need to be developed downstairs. My typical routine is going into the winter going, you know what, this winter I'm actually going to shoot. And then I get into the winter and realize I don't want to shoot. And it just puts me in this giant state of depression. And I just like, I curl up in a ball for a while and just go into hibernation. So instead of that, I said, you know, I'm going to really challenge myself in a way that I've never been challenged. Normally I'm very much, I got a pack on, so normally I shoot, I develop, I scan, and it's posted up on Instagram within that week, you know.
Yeah.
I said I'm not going to approach the New York work apart from the dark room, so I'm not going to scan them in. If anything, I'm going to scan the prints in, and that will be it. So that's going to be my big project for this winter, as well as some zines that I'm putting out and some YouTube videos. So
how did you first started learning about darkroom stuff? Is it something that you just researched on your own, or did you go and find? Is there a place in Grand Rapids where you can study this stuff and you can rent out a darkroom? Or
so yes, there are some evening courses that you could take for darkroom printing. We have an art college here in town. Emily actually goes to the art college for her degree, but it was mostly just through. I mean, it, not even mostly. It was entirely through YouTube. I think I looked up Ted Forbes' video on it, and then I was like, yep, I got it. I'm going to run with it. And I just fumbled my way through it, but luckily I actually had some pretty good success right off the get-go. So.
And I don't mean to be rude or nothing, but how much of Murphy's Law did you run up into when you started doing this?
It was, well, I you know, to be surprised, I'm actually blown away by the fact of how, I'm not going to say that I found it simple, because that is false. But I did not hit as many snags as I anticipated that. Good. I was going to, apart from a couple times of leaving the lens open, you know, to, you know, F4 or whatever versus stopping down, or, I haven't exposed a whole bag of film or of paper or anything like that. So it's been good. Go. Yeah.
We were just talking yesterday about, yeah, some people, when they're first starting out with a dark room, they don't really realize that the enlarger is a camera into itself.
Exactly.
It's something that goes, it's literally the opposite way around, where, you know, with a camera, you're pulling the light in to expose the surface.
Exactly.
You know, the enlarger, which should in its own right is a camera, is literally blasting light out to, you know, imprint a surface on the outside.
Sure.
But it's hysterical to me because I'm working on setting up a darkroom. It's a little bit more difficult to do out here in the Bay Area because of infrastructure and crumbling this and building codes and this, that, and the other.
Or space.
Yeah. Well, okay, but the wonderful thing that we do have is there's still something of a plethora of places that have rental dark rooms. Mm. And it's always fun to go to these places, but I'm going to tell you, you always can figure out the folks who are just starting out at this, and they're not necessarily paying attention, because you'll have someone like, you're sitting there, about a week ago, I was in the darkroom, and I was trying to print triptychs on one single sheet of paper, and dude comes in and he has to check his Facebook thing every 5 minutes in the dark room. And you're like, okay, look, like, please, please, I
please
guess.
Respect you, everyone you, else in this place and
like,
put
please.
Your addiction to the side. Yeah.
So those kinds of things happen. So, all right, that's cool. Okay, which there's another question for you. From building the zines to developing your own film and now to getting into printing, you seem to be addicted to the tactile experience of things.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. And I think it's a very common thing for us film photographers to say of we're process driven. I think it's become almost a buzzword, but at the same time, I just miss the idea of craft, right? I think of my grandfather who passed away years and years ago, and just my grandmother finally moved out of the house that they were in, but for the longest time his wood shop in the basement was untouched. And just going down there and seeing the pieces that he had made with his bare hands, right? The things that he was crafting with his bare hands, and my other grandfather did that as well, and I mean, it just seemed like it was a thing of that era to where everything was done by hand and done. And then we've moved to where we rely on computers and we rely on technology and we rely on our tools, which is not a bad thing. Like, I enjoy relying on part of my camera for weddings and not having to think too much technically. And but at the same time, with my own work, I want it to be a craft. I want to have crafted something from the start to the finish, right? I want to be able to speed up my agitation process if I want to induce more contrast, or I want to slow it down if I want to reduce the contrast, or, you know, these different little, like, these tweaks that we can make in the whole process. When you get to that final print, whether it be, even if somebody's, you know, scanning in and printing on the inkjet, when you get to that final print, you know that you've crafted that thing and that you're actually offering something to someone that you've spent time on, you've labored in. And especially in the darkroom, I'm going through paper left and right trying to figure this stuff out. And I'm like, I dodged too much. Now I got to go back and I got, you know, and trying to figure these things out. And when I do get that final print, I look at it and it almost brings me to tears because I'm like, here you are, my little baby. I've poured into you and now go off into the world and do your thing, you know? So it's, it's well,
okay.
That,
would you say that's like a sense of pride, a sense of accomplishment that's personal,
sure.
You know, not something that you're going to be like, look at what I did. I made this print and aren't I awesome because I made this in the darkroom.
Sure.
It's a thing that you say to yourself of like, you know, you look at the print and you're like, you know, and then you think back how much time, how much thinking you have to do. Okay, I need to shave a little bit of time off here. I need to dodge here. I need to burn there.
Sure.
And then you look at it and it's like you said, it's your baby, you know. And it's not necessarily something to brag to other people about, but that sense of accomplishment that you feel like, you know what, this is the image that I had in my mind and here it is on an actual piece of paper.
Sure.
Right. And through the chemistry of it, right? Because what is photography? It's all about the light sensitive nature of things. That's not to knock inkjet prints or printing CMYK in general. I mean, that's been around for a long time too, but there is that beauty of, oh my God, like, this isn't ink. This is
right.
This is chemistry and you burned this stuff like on the surface. It's amazing. And there's something to take pride in, that a real personal sense of accomplishment with that. I'm rambling now.
No, it makes total sense. It's like you're not dealing with ones and zeros or dots and lines. You're dealing with organic substance that responds to the thing. I don't know. I kind of think about it in this way, and not to go too esoteric on this, but the material is responding to the very thing that I responded to in the first place. The thing that grabbed my attention and stole my heart in the first place, that made me pull the camera to my eye, the film plane, you know, like, you have your emulsion that's responding to that same light, and then you get to represent that light onto another emulsion that you know, like silver gelatin gets to respond, and all of a sudden there's a series of responses along the way versus a series of decisions. I made the decision, not the camera. I don't know. And again, that's a little lofty in thought process, but at the same time, I like that kind of stuff.
Well, okay, lofty, but it also gets into that whole idea of what is an enlarger for? Mm-hmm. An enlarger is built for a very specific purpose,
sure.
Right? Whereas, and again, I don't mean to sit there and say that digital is bad and or anything like that, but you know, with my computer, with my laptop, where I edit my digital stuff, you know, well, that's also where I go take a look at Facebook. That's mm-hmm. also where I get my emails. But the enlarger, I'm not going to go and read my news on the enlarger, right? You know, the enlarger has one, you know, what I'm trying to get at is, it's that singular, every tool has its own particular sure. process.
Sure.
And as a result of having to follow the steps of that process, it focuses mm-hmm. Just exactly what it is you're trying to accomplish. And it makes you think hard about, okay, what am I really doing this for? Because do I want to blow a crap ton of money on paper and then have nothing to show for it?
Right.
Or do I want to make this right? And how do I make this right? What am I making right? And what's this eventually going to be? And for me, it's a thing, if you think about that stuff all beforehand, and all of a sudden the ideas start to come and foment from going through the process that way, that tactile thing of working with instruments that have a dedicated purpose to them.
Sure.
Again, I'm
not being used for anything else. Yeah.
Oh,
it's a good thought process. I like that. You know, another point of it too is talking about this whole idea of going into the meat and potatoes, right? Talking about the whole idea of thinking deeply and thinking intently on our artwork, on our craft, on our photography, on what we're trying to offer to the world. So much of life has been filled with busyness. We were just talking about schedules a little bit ago of how our schedules get so filled up. But when you make time for developing film, when you make time for the darkroom, it gives you that silence that oftentimes we're lacking in our life, or oftentimes we're quick to fill with, you know, Facebook and the phone. But you can't. You're not going to pull out unless you're the guy in the you know, community darkroom that you're dealing with, but you're not going to pull out the phone and approach it. It gives you time to actually think about the work that you're creating. It gives you time to approach, you know, your thought process and really what it is and why it is that you think about the things that you do. And I the more silence that I can get in my life, the better.
Concentration and focus, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
It makes a difference. Well, let's get a little technical here. Just a quick sure. question. Coming back to the developing thing, you a metal or plastic guy?
Plastic. As far as developing tanks, yeah, Patterson tanks. And then I have some other tank that the tank works well, but the reels are absolute junk. So I don't know. I'd prefer Patterson over everything else.
Yeah. You're more of a plastic guy too, right?
It depends on which format of film.
Oh, 120, 35.
Yeah, for a 35 millimeter, I'm all plastic just because it goes so much faster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the downside to that is, I mean, you have to have those reels like spot dry before if you even want to think sure. about putting the film in. That drives you nuts. But I mean, if you have a system, you work the system out. Mm-hmm. And for me, the plastic goes faster. It's a bit messier when you're agitating the tank, because no matter what, there's no real good seal on those on
sure.
those,
yeah,
those stupid Patterson tanks. But medium format film, give me the metal tank because the thin, you know, how thin the film is on medium format. If you start to get a little bit of a snag in the plastic reels, it just bends the living hell out of the film, and it can actually damage the emulsion side badly. And so it's like, okay, give me the metal reel because there's less of a chance that I'm going to damage the emulsion on that.
Sure.
And if we're talking large format photography, I've got this lovely thing. It's I always blank on who it is. It's actually a guy out here 45. In California. I think the SP 45, it's this small tank,
plastic tank
with
grenade,
the sheets.
Yeah.
And that's for me was like the godsend, because it used to be this gigantic brick where you would have to pour like a liter and a half of chemical in there to be able to cover everything. Now it's just like, you know, like half a liter and that's all good. The chemical you need, and you're developing four sheets in one shot.
Sure.
And I'm like, yes, this is brilliant. This is brilliant. We can do that. So plastic, metal, I'm either or. It depends on the format. Let's put it that way.
Sure. I'll have to try the metal ones for the medium format. I stopped shooting medium format for my personal work because, like, I like sanity. And I was saying words that I normally do not say when I was, you know, and my wife comes in. She's like, hey, what's going on? I'm like, I'm doing medium format. And she just goes, oh, yeah, okay. And Emily's developed film in the past and has printed in the darkroom too, so she just knows. I just hate having to get into the dark bag and try to load on 120 film. It drives me nuts.
Have you tried it on the metal reels yet?
No.
Oh, try it on the metal reels. Seriously, it does. It's infinitely easier than doing 35 millimeter on a metal reel. No question.
I'll have to, yeah. I had some reels too, some reels and tanks back in a while back, but I just gave them away. I was like, hey, if you want these, you can have them, but I'm sure I could find some more on Craigslist or something.
Oh, that's probably one of those mailroom giveaways, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Which actually, you guys out there listening, you do have to take a look at Nick Exposed because he's got a smorgasbord of different types of shows. And the one I'm alluding to is we explain it a little bit. People will send you zines or prints, and you get to show these on your video stream, right?
Yeah. So just been super grateful that the people have just responded to the channel extremely well. And right from the get-go, people were reaching out asking for an address if they wanted to send anything in. And since then, I've gotten tons. I don't know. You could probably actually see there's a giant stack of mail behind me that has zines and prints and people sending cameras. And it's incredible. I mean, somebody sent in a Holga. Somebody sent in, a Nikon FG, all sorts of stuff. I'm waiting for someone to send me, like, a Leica M3. So if any of your listeners want to
nice.
Just follow through with that. But, no, it's been incredible. Yeah.
It's now send that M3 to Street PX. Actually, we're good. I'm okay.
You know, I was gonna say it's like actually I think you know Nick's got the Christmas wish list there.
Yeah, right. No, so yeah, people have sent in stuff, and now I have kind of like a little pile of cameras, and I hesitate to say that because now I'm gonna get a bunch of people reaching out asking for cameras, but I do have a pile of cameras that will be in future giveaways and different things like that. So.
Yeah, that's what the contests are for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, which, not to tangent, but we have a contest going on right now where it's not as cool as yours where we're giving cameras away, but we are giving art, as in prints and film. So if anybody out there listening goes and follows us on Twitter or Facebook and shares some of our stuff, that puts you into the drawing to win some nice HP5 or maybe some Tri-X. I don't know. Kind of depends on it. It's going to be something good. I'm sorry, but not the 3200.
Nope. I'm hoarding that. I'm hoarding that like a bitch. I mean, pardon my language, but I'm hoarding that like a bitch. No,
I don't believe you.
Let us give that away.
I'm not letting. No, I thought about it. I thought there was a problem. I was like, you know what? Maybe I'll give two rolls and donate to filming. Then I'm like, no, this is why you crazy. They're never making this film again.
Sure.
Just going to pop in real quick to throw some love to our sponsor, Glass Key Photo. This is San Francisco's premier analog photography store and a staple for many photographers here in the Bay Area. If you're looking for analog gear, repairs, film, old or new, amazing zines by local artists, or simply want some great company and the opportunity for some fun photo walks, this is the place to be. You can find out more information and upcoming happenings by following them on Facebook or Twitter by searching Glass Key Photo or visit their website at glasskeyphoto.com. Now, after 5 years in the colorful and historic Haight District, they have relocated closer to downtown. You can now find them at 1230 Sutter Street. That's between Polk Street and Van Ness. It's a fantastic new venue offering a ton of space, breath of fresh air, I'm sure, for not only Gordon and Matt down there, but all photographers here in the Bay Area. Above all, while in San Francisco, be sure to visit Glass Key Photo and give a big hello from all of us here at Street PX. Well, jumping back over to the show, I wanted to go ahead and switch us over to, this is going to be a big tangent shift here, but scanning.
Sure.
We kind of match a little digital with a little bit of analog. Me and Pete were
talking. Allowed, I guess.
Yes, me and Pete were talking about this here recently, and we actually got a question from the YouTube channel there But as far as for scanning, is that something you're doing, or is it mostly darkroom?
So I do scan. Scanning was the process for me for the longest time. Like I said, I just picked up the darkroom about a month and a half, 2 months, maybe 3 months ago. But as of right now, I'm focusing more on darkroom just to, one, give myself something to work on through the winter, but two, to be able to approach my work in a way that I've never approached it before, and to be a little bit more selective on the way that I'm making my selects. But I love scanning. I still scan. I'm scanning through the HP5 shots that I did at that wedding a couple weeks ago, and scanning is a huge part of the workflow still.
Yeah, what are you using?
So I have a Pacon F135 Plus over here, and then I also have an old Epson Perfection 3170 flatbed that does well enough with medium format especially.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say flatbed scanning. The Epson works well enough. And then, but the only problem is it's like, okay, hold on a minute though. You know, sometimes you look at it and you're like, you look at the dusting job that you want to do. And again, this kind of goes back to the done versus perfect. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if you forget to clean off the surface of the flatbed, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden you have like 1,000 dust specks on there and you're like, oh. Then you're like, okay, what are the alternatives? What your other scanner, is that more like a cool scan scanner or?
So kind of in a way, well. Actually,
believe it or
no,
not, I'm
not
familiar with this type of scanner. So,
oh, really? Yeah. The Pacon. It has a bit of a cult following. The Pacon is kind of the one that it's a dedicated 35mm scanner.
Yeah.
If I could, I'd lift it up and show it to you right now. But it has a little bowl in the front that it catches the film. So it just scans the entire roll through and then it feeds out the other side and then catches in a bowl. And it's pretty incredible. I use the TLX external software. It's not the software that was originally made for it. Okay. And it allows for just some extra goodies to be pulled out of the film. So,
because I would love to try and see if, you know, can anybody win the lottery and possibly like, you know, purchase like 30 grand worth of a drum scanner?
Oh, I know.
Oh, man.
Please.
Seriously. I just had one of my 35 millimeter NAGs drum scanned over at Indie Film Lab. And because in an exhibition we hung this week, and I wanted to print it large. So I printed a 35 millimeter NAG up to, I think it's 44x68. And on the drum scan, I mean, it's grainy anyways. I love grain. Yeah. I pushed Delta 100 to 400 for this particular shot. And the grain printed beautifully. I mean, at that size, it was incredible.
Was it nice and sharp?
Yeah, it was really sharp. The drum scan just nails it. The Pacon that I have, too, that's especially what it's known for is just the incredible, incredible sharpness and grain structure that it's able to scan in.
Well, if we're talking scanners.
Well, there you go.
Here's what I'm showing for everybody that's just listening in is my Minolta Bellows system.
What do you hook that up to?
Funny enough, I actually use a converter to Minolta to Olympus.
Okay.
And I use my old Micro Four Thirds.
Oh, that's fantastic. I seen one of those over on in the case over at the... That's awesome. Over at the case in the camera shop. Does it work well?
Yeah, it actually, I mean, it works for what it needs to. The only problem is the macro 50 millimeter that I've got on here.
Mm-hmm.
I was a victim of eBay.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a wonderful macro lens that the aperture is stuck at f11.
Oh, so you got to supply plenty of light in there.
Yeah, so if I want to change the aperture on this thing, I've got to like smack it around. But I mean, it was only like $20. The whole system itself together was like $75, and it came with everything, like the little the slide scanner piece here, the rolls, so I don't have to actually cut my film.
Sure.
I think that's probably my favorite part is I can just run a 36 roll film through here without cutting it, and then just store it later.
That's amazing.
Which cool. How are you storing yours?
Very terribly. I don't know. I do not have a good system. People have been asking me, "Hey Nick, can you make a YouTube video on how you archive your negatives?" And I'm like, "That'd be the worst YouTube video ever." Like, I just put them in the plastic archival sleeves, and honestly, I have about probably 130 unmarked archival sleeves from this year. That
I've got about, yeah, I'm in the same ballpark.
I was marking them pretty well earlier this year, but then I just kind of fell off, and yeah.
The best way to do that is, and this, yeah, it always becomes a difficult thing. But if you can get the scratch together for it, find some archival binders where those folks who still make them, they're like the plastic binders that actually buckle closed. I have an entire wall of those at my place, and it drives me insane because I always look at it and I'm like, you know, like, what's going to happen if something catches fire?
Gone.
You know, but I mean, you'd still, the idea is, all right, now you have to try and keep this organized. You have to try and figure out how you're going to layer this stuff. Going back to the whole tactile experience and getting and doing a hands-on process. Well, you know, here you go. You have to, let's order this in the best way possible.
Yeah, I think that's one of my big projects for this winter too, is going back through. And I've luckily all those archival sheets have been scanned in, and I do a very good job at cataloging my scans. So I can go back through, and it's just going to be a tedious process. I'm just terrible with organizational and administrative stuff. So I just wish that I could outsource this stuff as much as possible, but I'll just have to figure out a system.
Do you sometimes make digital contact sheets?
I haven't. Oh.
Okay, so if you get yourself something like a big enough tablet or just a simple light table,
sure.
And you have photo software, because now I think a lot of smartphones are capable of shooting in the DNG RAW format. Mm. If you have that kind of phone, or JPEG works just fine, but as long as you have some kind of photo editing software that gives you curves.
Oh, sure.
What you can do is you just lay the transparent negative holders on top of either the light table or, you know, a completely white screen on a tablet, and then you just photograph the negative, and then you go into the photo app and you reverse the curves, and you have a digital contact sheet that is going to save you a lot of money in paper, because I'm sure you found out in the last couple months, you know, darkroom paper, like actual photographic paper, is not cheap.
Sure.
And making contact sheets is literally just like, well, that's throwing money out the door. That's one area where I will actually take the digital over the film, is when it comes to making contact sheets. I will use this little tool and do that all the time.
Nice. That's a good tip. I like that.
To that point, I recently come across a friend of ours, Mike Padua, had suggested a cool application that's in, it's being cooked right now. It's called Film Lab. Mm-hmm. And it's, their anticipation is both iOS and Android, but it's a app dedicated to film scanning.
Nice.
Using like a light, I'm sure you like Box or something like that, but it's fascinating. I am sure it's going to be more on the contact sheets side of things, like what Pete was talking about. I sure wouldn't want to rely on my cell phone to give me my exhibit.
That day is coming sooner than you think.
Nokia and their way of trying to come out with these big camera lenses on the, you know, the big bulge. I give them credit. I mean, you never know where the future. Wait till Lytro and cell phones come together.
Yeah, right. I do tell people, like, people ask me my favorite cameras all the time, and apart from my Leica, my iPhone is probably my second favorite camera. I just absolutely, there is kind of a mystique to the iPhone lens and everything that I could do with Filmborn from Maston Labs and Snapseed. That actually, my current zine that I'm working on is all photos taken with the iPhone. And so I don't know, I kind of like that they're trying to pack more into the phones, because it is one of my cameras that I still kind of revert back to it from time to time.
Yeah,
a lot of people are doing it. What is it, Scott?
Scott Strazanti.
Scott Strazanti just released a book, From the Hip, and it's all iPhone shots. But this is a guy who I mean, he works for the San Francisco Chronicle, Pulitzer Prize winner photographer, all the gear like you wouldn't believe. But he just released a book of only iPhone iPhone photography. Yeah. So it's spreading.
Yeah, yeah, that's cool. I don't know. I think it has the imperfect qualities that I love in film too. You know, so it kind of has a romance and mystique to itself. So.
That's an interesting concept. It's accepting and warming to the little quirks and instabilities.
Totally. I feel like if you were to ask me if I were to go out and shoot street with either my 5D or my iPhone, I'd probably pick the iPhone every single time. It's just one of those things, yeah.
Oh, it never crashes
on me, yeah.
I forgot to see if we actually have any wonderful listeners out there with anything to tell us.
Yeah, I forgot to put up the window for that.
Yeah, I did too. I had a question here from Manuel. He says, any tips for seeing a scene in black and white?
Nice.
So I'll let you take that torch and run with it.
Sure. I think the biggest thing is learning to see in tonal range. I search out light first and foremost, and I search out good light first and foremost. My black and white photos, I like to have a punch to them. I like to have a certain amount of contrast, even if the day isn't necessarily a punchy contrast day. It's really learning to, there's a thing called figure-ground relationship, and the thing that you're photographing, when we see in color, just to kind of run off on this tangent real quick, when we see in color, colors separate themselves naturally. But when you look at the tonal ranges of those colors, they tend to blend in more often than not. So you want to look at tonal values and actually look at highlights to shadows and placing whatever it is that's the subject of your photo on whatever it is that's the opposite. If it's a highlight that you're shooting, you're placing it on a shadow. Or if it's a shadow that you're shooting, you're placing it on a highlight and really playing off of that. So the biggest thing is... this is one of the core elements of photography in the first place, is to see tonal range and tonal values. So that's the number one thing. If you were to go out there and focus on seeing tonal proportions and ranges and how different tones play off of the others, within the next 2 weeks, you'll be a much better black and white photographer, I guaranteed.
Couldn't agree with you more. I think one of the first things that anybody should learn, whether they're doing film or digital or any kind of photography or just sticking with their iPhone, is how do you look at a scene? How do you judge it exactly that way? And how do you use your light meter?
Mm-hmm.
There are, and that's no joke. There have been a couple of classes that I've taught. There have been a couple of folks that I've dealt with. And one of the things that I find stunning, people who've been shooting for years, and hoping to get this and that or the other, and then you ask them a simple thing: do you know how to use light meter, and do you know how to, you know, measure light, do you know how to judge light with your eyes? So few people like get caught up on that. And I think it has to do with the paradox, you know, of like, okay, wait a minute, if I want to have you know, my shadows bring out, well, then I have to meter for the highlights. If I want to have, you know, if I want to bring my highlights in and make those strong and have really deep shadows, then I have to, you know. It's something that people get tripped up on a lot. People should learn to use your light meter, please. Sure. Everybody.
Sure. Or yes. Learn to. I mean, one of the things too is learning Sunny 16. I feel is one of the best ways to actually see tonal ranges, because you'll start to meter and measure light with your eye, and you'll start to realize, okay, so it might be bright sunny daylight, but I'm shooting something that's backlit, so I'm actually metering with my eye for the shadow. So what's the tonal range of that shadow? And when you start to learn that, you start to see where different tonal ranges start to separate, and it kind of lends into the other thing of being able to see the figure ground relationship and everything like that. So I think another thing, you know, if we're talking straight, learning to be able to meter with your eye, you're going to be much more well equipped to approach any situation out there versus having to pull a camera up to your eye and then meter and then shoot. You can have it metered before you get to approach the scene. So I don't know. I love the Sunny 16. I pull the meter out for my wedding work just because it has to be precise, and you know, it's work that I'm delivering to a client. But at the same time, I can nail it 9 times out of 10 with just my eye, just because you learn to see different lighting situations, especially if if you hone in on a certain film stock in a certain speed that, I mean, I'm shooting 99% of my work is HP5 push two stops. And I just know it. I walk into a situation and I don't even have to look at the light. I know what I'm walking
Click.
Into. Yeah. And it's just, it's such an amazing tool to have in your tool belt.
It kind of expands on that one camera, one lens approach where you get used to a single bit of equipment. When you're shooting film, just bring the element of which film are you used to and just getting better at that specific system and kind of making it an extension of your own arm, of your own eye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So I can't find the name on this, but it was it's kind of a two-part question here. Developer, what's your developer of choice?
Okay, where we get? Yeah, this is one I'm curious about. What developer do you use?
Sure. So for the longest time, I've used Ilfisol 3. Okay. I use it at the 1-9, and the whole reason for that is it's the only developer that's sold locally here in town. So I'm like I said, I'm not the greatest at organizing and planning and everything like that. So I oftentimes wait until I'm out of developer before I realize that I need more developer. So it's nice to be able to just run across town and get that. But at the same time, recently, one of my followers and friends sent over some HC110 for me to try, and I've been using that and really enjoying it.
I'm gonna give you another recommendation, and maybe I'll even send a bottle your way. If you can get your hands on some Adox Rodinol, if you like things grainy. Mm-hmm. It's the developer for you. And the beautiful thing about that is,
it's as resilient as a cockroach.
It's as resilient as a cockroach. The dilutions are, small enough so that, or I should say large enough so that like one bottle will last you a really long time.
Sure.
Yeah.
And you will get, if you like the kind of grainy quality that I've seen in some of your stuff, you're going to absolutely love it, especially paired with HP5.
Yeah.
Rodinol, HP5, just, wow, beautiful stuff. Really beautiful negs. But prepare yourself because you're going to be looking at like a 21-minute long development time.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, okay. Yeah.
But you also have a like 6-year shelf life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because sure. I like Infosol too, or Infosol. But its shelf life is this side about what, 4-6 months? They're about before it browns out.
That, once it's opened, I mean, especially when you get down to a half a bottle or less, it exhausts pretty quick. And that was one of the things that drove me nuts about it.
I have seen some tips that people use marbles, like trying to keep the air out, and they'll drop more and more marbles into
the
bottle as
the volume.
Yeah, so it takes the liquid up to the edge to keep as little air inside as possible.
Sure. Which with Ilfisol, you could actually do that because it is a true liquid developer for other things that are more gel based. You know, HC110 just pours out like honey.
Yeah.
Glue. I'm trying to. Yeah, exactly. It's crazy. The one thing that I have noticed with HC110 is my negatives, and I didn't realize this until after I scratched a few negatives, my negatives come out a little bit more gummy when they're developed, so they're a little bit softer and a little bit more fragile than Ilfisol 3. Ilfisol 3, when I pulled it out of the tank, I would just run my fingers down to squeegee off my wet fingers. It's not like I have calloused fingers or anything, but running wet fingers down the film.
You get those soft hands.
Yeah. I have long hair and I put coconut oil in it, so they're just always conditioned. People are like, you have the softest hands. I'm like, it's the coconut oil. I'm sorry.
I'm right there with you.
But
that's why we have long hair, so we can have greasy hands for film.
That's right. Exactly.
I don't need the long hair. My hands are naturally greasy. So it's just, there's a thick coat of something on there that nice. You know.
Oh, my word.
But no, you're right. Yeah.
Maybe you could answer about the Rodinol, Pete. Does it come out pretty fragile after Rodinol? Is it pretty bulletproof or?
It's very bulletproof.
Cool.
And you're talking with someone. Well, okay. When I go to develop my own film, I've managed to jerry rig a place out back of my house where I develop my film.
My
shed. It literally looks. It could be a scene from like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie.
The rusty chain is just hanging right above you. Like,
you know, and the moldy wood and the nails sticking out for no apparent reason. And if you look at it, I think that there are a lot of diehard film folk who would probably look at the setup that I have and just hang their head in shame for even associating with me, that I would think about developing my stuff in a place like that. But look, you go with what you got.
Sure.
So, you know, I developed the Rode and all. One of the things I started to do, because we had the drought here in California, was, okay, try and minimize as much of the tap water as possible. And so I go out and I buy myself distilled water. It's makes it a little bit more expensive. But the beauty about it is I'm not taking water out of the tap here when you have things like droughts. But also you get super clean water. You mix your chems with that stuff. And you're going to have a more, well, a cleaner outcome. Where that starts to hit the fan is, inevitably, you're going to probably stick that film under the tap water to wash it. Because if you got a 5-minute or a 10-minute wash on it, trying to constantly, you know, all right, every minute you add in new distilled water and then shake it for about a minute and then repeat for like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, that tends to get a little bit tedious. So if you do it in the tap, you pull it out, and there's going to be, once it dries, there are going to be mineral deposits on it. That's where you put in the photo flow. You stick it in the photo flow, and one of the things that I've stopped doing is actually squeegeeing my my negs, because I found that you can scratch the emulsion really bad. No, with the Rodinol, it's, your negs come out looking wonderful. They're ironclad. They will not be harmed.
Nice. Yeah, that's just, I've noticed that I didn't get much dust on my Ilfisol negs, but the emulsion being so gummy has really kind of started to attract dust that I'm not used to, and it's kind of frustrating to me. But at the same time, I have been enjoying HC110, but I would love to try Rodinol. People have told me about it for a while.
Well, I mean, I see by the film that you have back there, at least you're not hanging your film in a woodshed.
Right. Those will be your woodshed years. When people talk back on your photography, these were his woodshed years. You can see the bark at the bottom here.
It's your barn period.
Yeah, that's right.
Look at these wonderful scratches. Not to push this along, but I do want to go ahead and throw this. It was a second part question. What they were saying was what to do with chemicals after.
Ah.
Sure.
So you don't want to kill the environment.
Yeah, what do you do with your chemicals, Nick?
Yeah, I just pour them out the back window and just kind of...
You're better than me. I just poured out the car driving down the highway.
Really? Oh, see, because I usually serve it to unwanted guests as cocktails.
Well, wine?
There you go. Yeah. No, I... So for Fixer, I bring it over to the local college, the art college, and they have a whole process for stripping silver and hard metals, and they will dispose of it for me. So
good, nice, good. So nice. Local university, local college, some place that offers.
Oh, typically, there's still plenty of places around in most areas. Most universities, hopefully, at least around me, most universities are still doing darkroom stuff and will help you to dispose of that properly. So.
Okay, one of the other things that you can do out there, if you don't have an area that will reclaim the silver from your fixer, you can always go check out your whatever your local municipality has for household hazardous waste. They'll take your chemicals. They say with things like Developer and HypoClear and Stop Bath that they're somewhat okay to pour down the drain. In certain developers, I would say yeah, but
it's the dilution ratio too.
It's the dilution ratios. It also depends on the sewage system. Where exactly is this water going? Yeah. What kind of treatment plant do you got?
Or if you're rural and you got a cistern or something like that, septic right. tank. You know.
Something like that. So the better bet would be, and again, this goes back to, I actually have a process where, since I buy gallons of distilled water, I save those emptied out gallons as those are my waste gallons that I will pour the waste chemicals in. I usually separate the fixer from like the developer and the water stop bath and the HypoClear. and separate the things, and you know, the stuff that you can't reclaim silver out of, just bring it down to the household hazardous waste. Look them up, folks. Your county actually has them. They're on the website. You can find them, and I bet you they'll take your chems away for you.
Oh, I'm sure they will.
Google is your friend.
Yeah. And you don't want to, yeah, for anybody listening, you definitely don't want to mix your developer and fixer into the same bottle. Those will produce a very, very toxic gas that you do not want to be breathing in. So
yes.
I have heard there's a way of like decanting fixer.
Using
steel wool pad.
Yeah.
But I put it, I don't know if I did it wrong or if I was expecting something. I don't know what to expect, but I put it in there and it just like disintegrated the steel wool. And yeah, I don't know. So
I got a bucket out on the porch where I tried the same concept. I think I just became like an alchemist and created my own new metal. I don't really know what the fuck is happening.
Something was floating around on the top and I wasn't sure what it was. And yeah. I was like, well, okay,
new
I'll
colors,
talk that one off.
Yeah. And, well, cool. One of the go ahead and end it with a couple more questions here. Do you have a photographer that you want to recommend for our listeners to check out?
Sure. Can I do a couple quick ones?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. You can do a couple of long ones if you'd like.
Sure. One of the ones that we talked about earlier is Jay Mazel. We talked about his quote that he threw out there, but absolutely love Jay Mazel. He's shaped so much of the way that I think about approaching street and in street photography. And I know that Kelby One or Kelby Training or whatever they call themselves now had three amazing, they were like an interview series, but it was them walking around with Jay Mazel on the streets of New York and on the streets of Paris. And they were absolutely fantastic. So Jay Mazel is one that I absolutely love. Ralph Gibson is also a classic. I'm sure probably a lot of the listeners may have heard of both of those, but Ralph Gibson has been a huge influence on shaping the direction of my current work and just where I want to bring my work. And then the last one is Kit Young. His handle on Instagram is KitYoung135, as in 135 film. And Kit is one of those guys who is just a beast with the camera. The things that he creates and how he's able to create the vast work and the vast body that he's been able to create in the years that he's been shooting, it's almost like he can't take a bad photo. And it's frustrating in so many different instances. And I know he's also an amazing darkroom printer. He doesn't share anything except for his darkroom prints. And I know that he's an amazing color of his work, so he's very selective on the work that he does share. And it lets off this Superman aspect of him that you just think he's completely unreal. And yeah, Kit's a great friend and just an amazing, amazing photographer. So I think anybody would be inspired by his work.
Great recommendation. And you're right about that. I mean, it comes down to you will always be judged by the weakest link in your portfolio.
Sure. Sure.
So never hesitate to kill the babies and cull it down and keep on culling.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay. I got one last question for you. And we're going to throw this one out here. Let's go into the La La Land of what if.
Sure.
If you could photograph any place and time since the inception of the camera, where would you do it? Why would you do it? And how would you do it?
Sure. I was thinking about this one, knowing that you guys were going to ask it. And I think the best answer that I could give is probably the 50s. And just the whole Rat Pack era, the whole Miles Davis era, and just being able to see these guys operating at their prime. I would absolutely love to just document so much of... Have you guys seen the Sammy Davis Jr. photo book?
Yes.
And just seeing so much of the behind the scenes of Duke Ellington and, you know, like, oh gosh, these guys are amazing. And to be able to go back and see some of these guys perform that I've never been able to see, that are still impacting my work and in the work of many others, I would love to go and honor them with my Leica and just photograph them and just chase them down and play complete fanboy of just entertainment photojournalism.
Color or black and white?
Oh, black and white. Hands down.
Oh, yeah.
Hands
yeah.
down.
And depending on the situation, if you took it deep, you could, you know, get some photos of them working with their mafia ties and
There you go. Exactly, right?
Okay.
Just get wrapped into that whole thing and go down that rabbit trail.
Yeah. See old blue eyes talking about people with concrete boots.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You just pray that you're never on that other end of that conversation. You're just like, man, I'm happy to be in the room with these guys because they're not talking about me. No.
Right, right. That's one of those moments where it's good to ask permission.
Well, I was going to say, like, do you remember the opening wedding scene in The Godfather when, like, the photographer comes up and takes a picture of the old dude and he, like, points out at one of his, you know, heavies? Right. Hey, man, that guy right there. A guy goes over, grabs his camera, smashes it to the ground.
That probably Nick, did happen back in the day.
Yeah, be careful.
That's why you take a Leica, because it would break the ground, not the camera.
Exactly. And just bounce back up into my hand, and I keep shooting.
Yes. Well, awesome. That's a great response. Well, let's go ahead and throw it out there. Where can our listeners see more of your work and see you in action?
Sure. Biggest places, I have a website. It's nickexposed.com, but honestly, it's broken right now. We switched platforms and the back end broke. So until I'm able to switch it over to something that I could actually post on, it's just all of my old posts. So don't go there. Check out Instagram, Nick Exposed. You could also check out Nick Exposed on YouTube. And then also, you could check out, I also have a film photography apparel line, that is over at Two Stops Apparel. And, that's on Instagram and then twostopsapparel.com. And that's one that I update more and more.
Is that the hat you got on there?
The t-shirt, all sorts of stuff, film related, everything over there, coffee mugs, stickers, and everything. Super proud of that.
Okay, so you got the hat on, and is it also a shirt as well, or?
Yeah, so it says Film League on this one, then it's got the Pentax 6.7 on the back, so it's kind of a play off of, I just recently gave away my...
I was just going to say, quick question on that one. How long have you shot with a Pentax 6.7?
I shot with it for about a year, and then just recently sold it to buy my Summicron for my Leica.
Okay, there you go. And what'd you think of that tank of a thing?
It's amazing. I mean, the 105 2.4 is the reason why I bought that lens, and it lived up to everything that it was ever made out to be. It's almost like shooting 4x5, and the only reason why I was happy with... Not happy, I mean, I've spent a couple nights crying ever since selling that thing, but the only reason why I was able to let it go out of my hands was because I do have a 4x5 and I could still, you know, play off of that whole, you know, 4x5 ratio and everything. But that's an amazing, amazing camera.
It's, there you go.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because I've been an owner of exactly that camera for about 17 years, and that thing, I often like to describe it as... not only is it a fantastic camera that makes beautiful photos, but it's also a great way to defend yourself if people are attacking you.
Yes, that's true.
And it's good for training your arms, you know?
That's right. Yeah, you won't be too scared to walk down some back alleys with that one in your hands. It's a pretty intimidating weapon.
Well, Pete, where can we find out more about your work at?
Oh, my God, you actually want me to plug my stuff.
Of course. That's what you get for being a guest host.
That's what I get for being a guest host. You can, if you want to check out some of the stuff that I have, it's 2812photo.photoshelter.com. And I'm on Instagram as 2812photography and 2812 on paper, two different accounts. The 2812photography is just sort of a vomitous mass of my Instagram for several years, and the 2812 on paper is literally nothing but prints, both inkjet prints, but primarily darkroom prints that I have on there. And you can find me wandering around in Berkeley or San Francisco. Just look for this strange face.
Excellent. Well, you can find out more information about me at recasper.com. That's going to be my workshops, all of my recent blog posts. Find me on Instagram at recasperphoto. But more importantly, go take a look at streetpx.com. That's where you're going to find all of our episodes, including this show. If you're listening to us on Hangouts right now live, it's going to be posting on Friday. If it's after Friday, then welcome to the past. Take a look at all of our other videos. We also have merchandise. If you're looking at the video now, I've got one of my shirts on, Street PX right here. We also have about 24 shirts with illustrated cameras, everything from a wonderful Leica 4 to Nikon things. My brain just went completely to mush. I even got an Argus brick on that bitch. So if you want a cool t-shirt, go check it out in the merch store. Above all, we do love reviews. Go take a look at us on iTunes. Throw us some reviews. Throw us some stars. And then when you're done there, go take a look at Nick Exposed, the links he was just dropping in, and grab you one of his t-shirts too. So thank you so much, Nick, for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Nick. And please keep doing what you're doing, because, out of a lot of the camera folks that that do their vlog, do their blog type of thing, you're one of the few people that I've seen over the years that actually has me perking up my eyebrows and being like, okay, that's it, spot on. Nailed it. Please go watch this.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that, and I'll definitely keep on.
Excellent. Cool. Well, thank you all out there in our audience, our both live audience right now in the Hangout, as well as you listening on your phones or computers later. If you are liking the show, go to patreon.com/streetpx and give a buck, give $5, whatever you give us. We'll go back into keeping our mics hot and our bandwidth flowing. Cool. Till next time, everybody. Cheers and keep on shooting.